Today on E&R Critical Path Podcasts, we will hear about how, in the wake of a collision and a raging fire, a team was able to reopen a critical link between Kentucky and Ohio in just 42 days. This is Eileen Cho.
And I'm Jeff Yoders.
And today we are having a Talking the Job Site podcast. Today we're talking with Stacy Hans, who is the Executive Staff Advisor for the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet District 6. We are also talking with Jason Stith, the Technical Manager for Bridges for Michael Baker International. Welcome, Stacy and Jason.
Thank you very much.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for agreeing to share the story of how you managed to overcome what sounded like a pretty serious event back in fall of 2020. Tell us what happened.
Well, thank you very much for having us on. As you mentioned, there was an incident that occurred on the lower deck of the Brent Spence Bridge that involved two semi-trucks, resulting in a fire that led to the closure of the structure. At that point, we had to evaluate what was going on and how we could advance reopening the structure and having it open for the traveling public.
Yeah, and this happened back in November, I want to say, 2020, right? It was a really freak accident. Two semis sort of hit each other on the bridge, right?
Absolutely. It actually occurred on Veterans Day, so November 11th in the wee morning hours. And like you said, there wasn't anything weather-related that should have led to it, so it was more or less just a freak incident.
Well, thank goodness it was in the wee hours, right?
Absolutely, yes. We've discussed that many times. Mm-hmm. Had it occurred, during rush hour or even during, like I said, wee hours, we're talking 2:30 in the morning, it could have been much worse. We experienced much higher traffic volumes, obviously, during the day. So if there was something to be grateful for, it was the time of day that it occurred.
Mm-hmm. So Jason, how long had Michael Baker been working with the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet on inspecting this bridge?
We have an on-call contract with the cabinet through their bridge maintenance department. And when the incident occurred, we had one of our engineers actually lives, just a few miles away up the hill from the incident and had seen it on a Twitter feed or something else and shot it around to us. And this was somewhere in the, 6 or 7 o'clock that following morning. And so by about 8 or 9 o'clock, we were in communication with KYTC's, head of their bridge maintenance department, Josh Rogers. And he was en route to the site and they had, the District 6 bridge engineer on site. And so by about noon that day, we were packing up and heading from Louisville, again, about an hour and a half away, towards the site to begin the assessment portion of it and try to see how bad is bad and what needs to be repaired.
Yeah, the Brent Spence is a major connection to Kentucky from the city of Cincinnati. And being from river cities such as Pittsburgh and Cincinnati myself, it's a key thoroughfare because you can't get across the Ohio without it. It's a very, big and it's a bit of an older bridge, right? So this needed to be fixed immediately, right?
Yes, to your point, the Brent Spence Bridge carries both I-71 and I-75 in addition to local traffic across the Ohio River from, as you mentioned, Covington, Kentucky into Cincinnati, Ohio. However, it's not just the local aspect of it. It is a key component of the national transportation network. If you're talking about 75 that goes all the way from Michigan to Florida, and it's an H structure. It was open to traffic in 1963, and it's a double-decked cantilever truss. So you have the northbound traffic traveling on the bottom deck, and then the southbound traffic traveling on the north deck. So those that are going from Ohio into Kentucky are on the north deck. But to your point, we do have other Ohio River crossings, but by far it carries the most traffic at an estimated 160,000 vehicles per day. And it was not the way the incident occurred. We couldn't keep the structure open. We had no idea how significant the damage was until we had conducted the inspections, which obviously was where Jason's expertise came into play. So the first thing we had to do is, in addition to trying to control the blaze and figure out what's going on with the incident, but was to immediately set up maintenance of traffic operations to redirect and reroute those 160,000 vehicles per day.
One other number that was quoted, and I think, Stacy, this is maybe you probably mentioned it to me, you know, and I know I sit on the deck with, you know, the chief bridge engineer from Ohio, and he said this is the most important bridge in the state of Ohio. And Kentucky would say the same thing. Economically speaking, there was said 3% of the nation's GDP crosses this bridge every year. There's a tremendous amount of commerce that uses this bridge, you know, locally, but regionally and nationally. And so having that shut down and having that much commerce being delayed and in their travels is a significant economic impact, like I said, to the whole region, really nationally, which kind of was a very substantial point and understood by everybody on the team, you know, the full teams that were working on this, of how critical reopening this structure was, you know, for all the time delays locally, but, you know, economically, to both states, it's critical.
Had you guys ever seen anything like this before on that bridge or for the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet bridges in general?
Simple answer to your question is no. This is a first-time experience for anyone in our district, and I believe it is one of the first experiences that we've had within our cabinet, within our state, within the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet. Now, Jason mentioned that we were able to reach out to the Ohio Department of Transportation, and they had experienced this on, I shouldn't say this because it was not over river crossings, but they had experienced a structure fire on one of their interstates. So we were able to pull in some of their resources and some of their wisdom gained from that experience. But from Kentucky's perspective and from the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet's perspective, this is the first time we've had to work through this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And for all those of us in the audience who have never been to Covington, there's a lot of commerce that goes down the river, a lot of barges and things, and you know, getting across from one side to the other, that's, you know, important for all the shipping of raw materials and coal and other goods, right?
Absolutely. And that's a great point that you brought up. We, you know, we've talked throughout this conversation about the vehicular traffic and the impacts that we had to that mode of transportation during the incident. But while the bridge was immediately after the incident, until it was completely inspected and clear, we also had to close river traffic. So we were working very closely with the Corps of Engineers. And we had a local person who was in our, what we call our meeting room or our project room. It was fantastic operation that we had set up. We were able to immediately mobilize, like I said, the U.S. Corps of Engineers. We had our environmental state resource agencies, our local first responders. We were all able to secure a room in the adjacent county building to where we could all have face-to-face conversations. But we did have to close river traffic for a time until the bridge was deemed safe, not in jeopardy of collapsing.
Jason, what kind of techniques did you use to survey this one so quickly and appraise it so fast?
Yeah. So when we went out there, we had several priorities for it. So, you know, the first priority is, it's safe for the inspectors to be out there. Can we deem that portion safe? The next part of that was, is it safe for us to open it up to vehicle or the maritime traffic, as we just mentioned? Like, is it, are the main structural elements of the truss likely to fall into the river collapse? So that was kind of the second level of it. And then thirdly, you know, is it safe for vehicular traffic? So we were able to relatively quickly assess, by looking at the members and the damage done, that it was safe for the inspectors to be out there and to be on the bridge and with the loading that we had. It took a little bit more, but not a lot longer, to figure out that overall, that the truss members themselves, focusing very intensely on the local area of the fire. Stacy mentioned this is a suspended truss. And what that means is, it's a three-span truss. And so the back two spans, if you will, are simply supported and cantilever out over the river. And then over top the river, there's a 450-foot suspended span portion of the truss that that's over the main channel. And the fire occurred right at that joint of the suspended span. And so one of the major concerns for us is there, in order to hold up the suspended span, there's a vertical member on each side of the bridge, on each end of that suspended span, that's holding up the entire dead load and subsequent live loads mm-hmm. from the suspended span, and had over 4 million pounds of loading in that member. So with the fire occurring at that location, there was a significant concern early on that if this was damaged, if we have issues with the suspended span, you know, we could potentially lose that. So that was one of the early concerns. And so we focused our efforts on looking at those members. And then also globally, you know, what else could have moved? When you have that much heat and thermal movements, thermal gradients, are your joints, bearings, wind locks, or other things that either perform properly and move too quickly, or didn't perform properly and cause some other locked-in stresses or bowed or buckled other members during the event. So we had inspectors, and KYTC pulled in a kind of a full team of inspectors in there, and we had plenty of resources to try to make sure the entire structure was safe from a global sense, and then to focus in on what we call the heat-affected zone around where the fire occurred, looking at damage, at warping, and other aspects to determine the safety of the structure moving forward.
So how bad was it, really?
The short answer is there was portions of it very bad. I mean, the fire occurred on the lower deck, as Stacy said. And as it turned out, the bottom deck that you drove on there looked very bad, and it was. It caused a lot of damage to that concrete. But that concrete essentially shielded the heat from getting into the members below deck. And so that was remained safe. Above the deck, the upper deck, that's where most of the damage ended up being. So the fire was, you know, the heat was rising. And for about 2 hours, that fire continued to roar there. And so the stringers and the floor beams saw a significant amount of heat. The stringers, they all warped and deformed significantly. This caused damage to the upper deck. The upper deck, which had full thickness cracks through it, while they were cleaning off and washing off the deck, you know, from the cleanup effort, water just kind of rained right through that upper deck. So it was completely structurally damaged to the point that it subsequently was replaced, but it was needed to be. The biggest, most fortunate part is that the main structural members, so the truss in these are made of boxes, and they're perforated boxes. And I think partly due to the fact that they had substantial size, they took a lot of heat, but they were all, because the steel was able to transmit that heat through those long members. And we had, you know, scarring and burning and heat damage well away from the fire area. But I think because it was well away, it was pulling that heat away. And so we ended up not damaging any of the main truss members. And that was the real benefit. That's the reason that we were able to open it up as quickly as we were, and that there wasn't more significant rehabilitation needed. And we took a good amount of time to come to that conclusion. Not a lot of time, but we worked diligently to come to that conclusion that there was no structural damage to those members.
Stacy, when the governor, you know, stood there a few hours after the incident and said, we want to get this job done and we want to get it done quickly, but also safely, was there any sense of the timeline that was expected for the bridge to be replaced? I mean, not replaced, repaired and reopened?
Repaired. Yes, absolutely. So, you know, by the time the governor had done his first press conference, we were still in the process of evaluating the extent of the damage. And the key point there is that we were going to be as efficient as possible with the time, understanding the impacts, but also at no point were we going to jeopardize the safety of the traveling public. Something that we have not mentioned is because of the heat and the debris that was left from the two semi-tractor trailers, it took us 24 hours to be able to get the debris removed to even begin those initial evaluations and to see the extent of the damage. But we worked diligently that first, you know, that first, once we were understanding a little bit, and I say understanding. It was real-time exchange of information between our inspectors in the field. And, you know, Jason was an incredibly significant part of that, but the people that we had in the field, as well as those that were, you know, working remotely, working offsite, but still trying to develop a plan forward. You know, there were some thoughts on what could be accomplished and how quickly it could be done. But understanding the impacts that were being done every day, we were given a timeline, and our it came directly from leadership and their sight and their foresight to understand what could be accomplished. Mm-hmm. You know, we had one thing in mind, and they said, well, how about if we shave a couple more days off of that? And once we were given the marching orders, we did everything in our power to make sure that we met that.
Sounds like a very collaborative effort. How quickly did the contractor, our good friends at Cocosin Construction, mm-hmm. get involved? Were they there at the beginning or a few days later? Or?
No, and you said a key word there. The collaboration that took place on this project was unprecedented for any project that I've been involved in. To answer your question, in the wee hours in the original schedule that we were doing, it was internal to KYTC. We had to get creative on how to bring a contractor on board. Being an emergency situation, we'd not experienced that. So we were developing bid documents. Like I said, exchange of information in real time, determining how we could put a contract out to be bid successfully while still following the correct procedures and processes. We had started working on bid documentation. We were able to bring some contractors on site Saturday. Had it open Sunday as well, letting them see. Yes, and we're talking the event occurred on Wednesday. Really didn't have access until more along the lines of Thursday because of the debris had started the bid development process, the documentation for that. And then by we knew when we wanted their bids, we opened that these had to be submitted by Monday morning I think we bumped it to noon. And then we had the contractor in a meeting with us by 4 o'clock on that Monday.
Wow.
So as you mentioned, Cocosin was the winning contractor, excellent partners throughout the duration of the process and the project. But we were like, it was unprecedented, mm-hmm. certainly not a process that any of us had gone through before. So we were developing as we went along in consultation and direct communication with our partners at FHWA, the Kentucky division, making sure that we were doing everything appropriately. But as you mm-hmm. mentioned, as quickly and efficiently as possible.
So it seemed, did you guys already have some kind of joint repair or other elements of the bridge? Did you have some plans for future upgrades or renewal that helped?
Yeah. So on the plan development side of things, we did, I mentioned the fact that the fire occurred at the suspended span. So there was a joint there that was damaged and needed repairs. They had previously were looking at doing some joint work from another contract that had not yet been let. And so we were able to take that information from that joint repair and include it in our plans. From our design side of things, the goal was, as you said, quick and efficient. We had to communicate the information needed and the fastest way we could. So the majority of our plan set were just taking the original drawings, design drawings, or the original shop drawings and circling them and saying, this is the member that's damaged and needs to be replaced. Here's the shop drawings with the exact dimensions that we want the fabricator to, drill bolt holes and cut the length, et cetera. We would write notes on it on, you know, the paint needed or other details that we would need to put in those regular contract plans. But we did minimal drawing development, mostly just because there wasn't time. As we were going through this, you know, we had electrical damage out there and we had to have electrical plans. And so trying to get these things developed and again, convey the information. As Stacy mentioned, on Saturday evening, we had a group of contractors out on site going through the scope of work that we had intended and was, again, still in the development stage. We were sending in updated plan sets, KYTC, on about a 12-hour cycle every morning and evening as we were working basically around the clock. And that information was then conveyed to the contractors as best we could so that they could, and as she said, from Saturday evening to Monday morning, you know, they had just over 36 hours to develop a bid for this project. And that did take the collaborative effort you talked about of everybody communicating intent, communicating requirements in order to make that process happen.
Hey, Jason, there was this pandemic thing going on that entire time as well. Not a lot of in-person contacts, I'd imagine. So how do you communicate that information? Did you use like a cloud service? Was there a 3D model shared between everyone, or how did it all go?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in one sense, the pandemic, you know, presents all these challenges, but just like with any challenge, it presents opportunities. And so we had been in a pandemic mode now for what, 6-9 months at this point. And so having regular Zoom meetings, having, you know, our remote calls just became part of the process. So we were in the field on a Zoom call with people in the office doing running analysis models, you know, with the, you know, Stacy and the MOT people, and making sure that, you know, we had that happening in the procurement. It actually, in some respects, allowed for better collaboration just because everybody was comfortable with the remoteness of everybody. But, you know, the normal back and forth that you may have or slowness of that communication, everybody's computers and phones and tablets were all set up to do that because we've been practicing that for 9 months. And so out of the challenge came an opportunity to use those same tools that we were developing to improve communication and to help collaboration. So it's a double-edged sword there, but in some ways, there were positives that came out of it.
Mm-hmm. Did you send shop drawings to the fabricator in like 3D or anything? Was there any way to get that information to fab quickly?
Yeah, so that was something, because of the speed of it, we didn't really hardly do any, very little CAD on our end at all. As I kind of mentioned, we took the original shop drawings and just annotated on those drawings because that was the fastest way to communicate the information to them, was to say, this is the original shop drawing. These are the links, recreate it, because it was a replacing kind. We didn't see a need for betterment of anything out there. So we weren't updating things. And it was just, here's what was existing. These are the members. As it turns out, in talking to the fabricator that did the work, I mean, as he said, man, those old guys knew what they were doing, and they have stuff down to the, you know, 32nd out there, and you start laying it out in a, you know, in a CAD program and their CNCs, man, these guys drawing it all by hand and doing the calculus on slide rules were pretty good. You got to hand it to them.
Yeah. Who was our fabricator? We got to give them a shout out. Yeah.
The fabricator on the product was Bottoms Engineering. They're a fabricator out of Frankfurt. That's kind of an interesting story in and of itself. So, you know, in a normal project, you know, you get a contractor on board and they give you a price and they say, all right, we're going to go out and contact a fabricator. They're going to, you know, find some steel that we need, the plates and the sections. But with this project, we didn't follow a normal procedure. By Thursday, after we finally were able to get out there, and as we mentioned, the stringers were in bad shape and there were other aspects that we are definitely going to have to replace it. We don't know how much we need to replace, but we do know we're going to need a replacement. So KYTC began the process of calling around and trying to procure steel members that could be used. And by Friday, so we hadn't had a contractor on board, that process hasn't started. KYTC had gone through and ordered steel for the replacement with the anticipation that when they got a contractor, whoever that would be, they would give them the raw materials and say, hey, we need you all to fabricate it, move it forward. It's just kind of another part of this process, that forward thinking that KYTC kept doing throughout the process to make it move along more quickly and save days anywhere we could.
Mm-hmm. Stacy, how many contractors bid, and did Coco Singh say, okay, we can get this done in 42 days?
We had two contractors ultimately submit bids for the project. And in addition to the cost component, there was the time component that we put in as part of the bid process. So yes, they had to guarantee that they would be able to meet the timeline that was established.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about the traffic management aspect of having to reroute these thousands of daily commuters and other traffic.
So we've talked about the various aspects of this project that were certainly unique, the emergency aspect of it. But we approached from KYTC's perspective, or the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet's perspective, we approached this project different than we would a normal project in the delivery of it, in that the secretary often refers to it as our three pillars. Normally, when you let a project to construction, the construction, both internally to KYTC and the contractor, are by far the lead. But this project, because we had to have the maintenance of traffic in place even ahead of awarding the construction contract, we had those three components that were the actual construction, the second one being the maintenance of traffic operations, and then the third one being our public awareness campaign. You specifically asked about the maintenance of traffic, and it was unique in that we had to bring in an independent. We handled that independent of the construction component because, one, the bridge was closed down. We were not having to try to move traffic through the construction site. You know, normally that's why you would have your contractors involved, because it would be actively going through their construction site or their work zone. In this situation, the maintenance of traffic operation was separate, and we handled that through an independent contract supplemented with our own KYTC staff. We called it a hybrid approach. We brought the contractors in to handle the larger operations, but we had our own staff, you know, setting the barrels, maintaining the variable message boards, which was key throughout the duration of the project. And then consistently getting real-time information or real-time feedback from our local first responders as far as what was working, what wasn't working. You know, normally on a normal project, you would have months and various checks and balances along the way when developing a maintenance of traffic plan. We were truly in a situation where we were developing as we went, and we're getting real-time feedback and making adjustments where needed.
To give a little anecdote about how 2020 this was, in Cincinnati, they were working on, I only know this because I'm the Midwest editor, and I did a story on the Columbia Parkway, where they were getting it was getting emergency stabilization itself, because they were getting a lot of rock slides and like hillsides slides on it. And when this happened, some people I know from ODOT told me that the reroutes from the Brent Spence went through, there was still one lane open of the Columbia Parkway. So it was real Armageddon there for a little while.
Jeez. Yeah. Well, it's pretty much Armageddon on the bridge during that incident, it seems. What was it, like 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit, they say?
That was the prediction, yeah, that it got somewhere in that range of 1,500 degrees. And at that temperature, like you said, the steel starts to soften. Mm. And we saw that in the stringers. What we were concerned about, kind of on the material side, once it gets that temperature and it's sustained for a certain period of time, the crystalline structure of the steel actually changes, and the physical properties change, and you get what they call martensite. It's kind of like a quenching, tempering, I mean, like a hardening of the steel, but it also makes it more brittle. And so there was some concern that we were changing the physical properties due to the fire. And that became one of the inspection things we were concerned about, was ensuring that we didn't have a change. And we confirmed through multiple ways of the testing it that we did not.
Wow.
I mean, Jason, many cities are built on rivers, older cities like Cincinnati. This accident was unique, but, you know, not so much that it couldn't happen on something like 376 in Pittsburgh. And does this really just bring home how much we being ENR and engineers and people in the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet understand that Our infrastructure is old, and many of the ASHI grades are C and D. Does this just bring home how much we really need to maintain our infrastructure properly in this country?
Yeah, like I said, anytime we have these types of incidents, whether it's you know, this situation or maybe even the current one down in the I-40 job in Memphis, right? You have situations where, you know, infrastructure comes into the key focus, and, you know, they're easy to forget about when they work well, right? You don't talk about things that are going well and when they're active. But when we have a situation like this, and it really, you see the disturbance in people's lives, and their ability to get to and from work, to get commerce moved in businesses. Amazon is a major hub there in Northern Kentucky. And so it starts to affect people in a real way, then it kind of comes into focus. And I think that helps make that case and make the communication of how important infrastructure is, even though it's often, you know, not seen that it's, while it's working well, you just kind of take it for granted. It does put a focus on it, and should put the focus on it. Why infrastructure investments are important, why we need to make sure that we have active programs in place to monitor and, you know, do repairs when needed and do replacements of bridges and increase capacity, so that when these type of events occur, we have remaining infrastructure that can handle the loads. When we do need to replace some bridges, that there's abilities to do that. And I think all those things should come into focus for a lot of people and help educate the more general public that doesn't focus on this every day, like the people on this podcast do.
Yeah. I made the argument at a previous job that we should make the story that bridge works just fine. And this was back when there was a bridge collapse in Minnesota many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the national news always said, oh, bridge collapses. Well, where's the story that bridge works just fine? You know? No one ever does that.
Yeah.
We do. Stacey, has there arisen out of the ashes of this incident a sort of informal or formal playbook or set of guidelines for in case this should ever happen again?
That's an excellent question. And one of the charges with the project, I can't talk about this project without talking about the excellent leadership that we had involved with it. You mentioned earlier about being during COVID and the nuances that brought. But with the benefit of being able to have the virtual meetings, we held nightly meetings with executive leadership. So they were able to be involved in every aspect of it and making those, being involved in the decisions. And as we were going through it, they had the foresight, like I said, with the leadership, they had the foresight to understand that this is something new. We've never been able to do this. We were reaching out to other DOTs. I'd mentioned ODOT, but as well as North Carolina, Georgia, just some of our partners. And throughout that, they were saying, wouldn't this be great if we had just a guidebook or just something that we could fall back on? So with that in mind, afterwards, we had breakdown conversations with each of the respective groups. As I mentioned, our maintenance of traffic team, our public awareness campaign, which was phenomenal on this project, as well as the construction components. We had to put some things in place for that to cover 24-hour inspections. But because of COVID, we actually had a backup team in case one of our crews, our inspection crews, came down with a positive COVID case. We had another crew to step in and, you know, not cause any delays. So all of this was captured in an after action report that, you know, we'll be able to refer to moving forward.
Excellent.
Just one other question about construction. I imagine there had to be several shifts for our friends at Cocosing to get this done in that amount of time. I mean, 40 some days is just such a turnaround.
Yes. And to your point, like I said, Cocosing was a fantastic partner throughout. They had their vision. They knew what needed to be done. We had iron workers going on site doing their work because, as you mentioned, there was some work outside of just the repair area that had been identified previously that needed to be addressed. We had joint repair work that had to be done immediately adjacent to the where the area, the heat affected area or the heat affected zone that Jason had mentioned. So while the bridge was closed and while there was no traffic on site, we included the repair of some of those joints that had already been identified, which ended up being a huge benefit to KYTC and to the traveling public, because we did not have to put in place separate maintenance of traffic to complete those repairs. So while the bridge was closed, we were able to do that joint work, which we were struggling to get done.
So 604 linear feet of stringers, 151 linear feet of concrete deck, over lower deck replacement of concrete overlay, and 75.5 linear feet of barrier on each side.
Sounds about right.
You know, and I think the Secretary Gray said it very well. I said the work that had to get completed, as in the end, wasn't the most complex construction site, but under complex conditions and intense pressure, right? They said the numbers you throw out there aren't large numbers in the end, in that, you know, what was needed to be replaced, but you did have it under extreme, COVID, winter weather and tight time constraints made the challenge for proposing out there in the contract.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
I hate to bring national politics into this, but I had read that Senator Rob Portman had, with a group of other senators, proposed as an infrastructure bill compromised, including $1 billion for the Brent Spence Bridge, as something to get an infrastructure bill passed. It's needed. What do you think about it?
I would say that, and I'm going to defer to Stacey on this because she has led this effort for KYTC for a while, and it's a project that's needed. It's obviously been on there for a while, and they've got some planning stuff as far as how they want to do it. But I think it'd be remiss, and I should stop talking already, but I'll let Stacey.
No, thank you, Jason. I appreciate that introduction, and absolutely. If you look at the Brent Spence Bridge, and I think it was highlighted with this experience, it's a capacity concern that we have going on. And, we need to continue to evaluate how we look at increasing that capacity. And, is it building a companion structure as the plans currently state, building a companion structure immediately west to it. But I think the huge takeaway from this project is that we have to continue to maintain the existing infrastructure, because as part of that plan, the existing Brent Spence Bridge remains in operation. So at this point, we have a current KYTC project or Transportation Cabinet project where we're thoroughly cleaning, blasting, and painting the Brent Spence Bridge. So we had it closed last November and December because of an emergency, but we already had a project on the books to fully strip it down and paint it as part of the life cycle operations and maintenance of the structure. So that we want to make sure that we're able to keep that vital piece of our infrastructure in place for many, many years to come. Mm-hmm. I think the secretary said it multiple times. I think maybe even the governor mentioned that it is a stout and sturdy structure. So structurally, there's not concern with the long-term viability of it. It's just the capacity issue. It's almost double what it was originally designed to carry. So we want to continue to maintain what we have while looking at opportunities to expand those capacity and meet those needs.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yeah, one thing we learned about supply chains over this last year too was that the needs are just going up. We haven't been able to solve everything the Zoom meetings yet. Trucking is still important. People still need things. Capacity is only going up, right?
Mm-hmm. And to your point, that corridor specifically has a high truck percentage volume, and which I think only goes to justify or to Jason's point earlier with our 3% gross domestic product crossing that structure. It is a significant cog in our economic driver. And with the addition of Amazon locally, we only expect that truck percentage to increase.
That hub is over at the airport in Erlanger, Kentucky, right? Isn't that an Amazon hub, I think?
Yes. Yes. It's the new facility that they're building that is rather large.
Yeah.
Well, for someone who is an Angeleno / New Yorker, I had to look up Brent Spence. It sounds like he was a pretty sturdy character too. So
that's a
sounds
good
like
way
it's
to
an
put
aptly
it.
Named bridge.
Yes.
Hopefully, this bridge will last till 92 years and even more, perhaps.
Hopefully.
Yes.
Wow, what a project.
What an amazing story of resilience and collaboration and managing to almost perform kind of a phoenix-like miracle to get this bridge reopened.
I like that reference.
It's kind of literal, you know? There's fire. There was fire.
Literal reference. I love it.
Right. And then was revived out of the
from the ashes. Exactly.
Well, thanks you guys so much for sharing your story with us, and hopefully this will be an inspiration. We hope that these sort of incidents never happen, but they probably will, unfortunately. So it's good that you're conveying lessons learned from this experience.
Absolutely. Like I said earlier, thank you so much for having us on. We could not have accomplished what we did with this project without the collaboration of our federal partners, our local partners, every aspect along the way. We were getting unprecedented support and just guidance. And anytime we had questions, we had multiple people reaching out to us to help get to a solution, understanding that at the end of the day, the goal was to get the bridge open efficiently, but also safely.
It's nice to be a part of such a great team. That teamwork and the team aspect of it that made this happen was really, really in some respects, stressful, but fun, right? It's really an interesting
right.
project. So it's good to be on a good team and have great partners to work with.
All right. Well, thank you, Stacy and Jason.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
This has been an ENR Critical Path podcast, Talking the Job Site. I'm Eileen Cho.
And I'm Jeff Yoders. For more ENR Critical Path podcasts, go to enr.com/podcasts. Also follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Thanks for listening.